If you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read it, you're misinformed.
Well, that's a problem. America, 2016. Is it over yet?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Not over yet.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM, people-powered radio in L.A., Radio Sputnik, and other fine affiliate partners, both terrestrial and otherwise. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. We've got a lot to get to, a lot to get through here out of South Carolina, where a federal jury has convicted Dylan Roof. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. I know everybody calls him Roof, but Dylan Roof in the racially motivated slayings of nine black church members during a June 2015 attack during a church Bible study at the historic Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Wow, June 2015. I didn't realize it was over a year ago.
I know, it's hard to believe.
It really is. The jury reached its verdict today, after less than just 2 hours of deliberations. The 22-year-old white supremacist, which some folks now refer to as the alt-right, at least when they're talking about Donald Trump and his supporters.
Those are the well-dressed ones.
Indeed. He was convicted on 33 federal charges in the killing of nine black people, including hate crimes and obstruction of the practice of religion. He apparently just stared ahead as the verdict was read, much as he had throughout the trial, according to AP. The jury of nine white and three black people will reconvene early next month to decide whether he should get the death penalty or be sentenced to life in prison. Now that may, I guess that sounds like good news. At least there's some accountability there. It would be good news, except it's probably the best news we have all day today.
And
I shouldn't say that at the top of the show. People are going to tune out. But, you know, we try to be honest. We try to tell the truth. In any event, Desi Doyen, and I always hate to say bad news, and now here's Desi Doyen.
And you'll have some more bad news
later.
Yes, well, there's some good news in there as well.
In our Green News report coming up a little bit later in the hour, more on the science denier appointments by not-yet-president-elect Donald Trump, including the super genius that he's tapped to head the nation's nuclear arsenal. But no, you're right. Here is some good news. The EPA admits that fracking harms drinking water.
See?
Seems like bad news, but I guess it's good news
it's
that they've admitted
it. It's wrapped
up
in a little pretty package of good news that they admitted.
Yes,
right.
And I won't notice the disturbing news about scientists screaming that the Arctic is absolutely falling apart. We'll just wait till we get to that part. In any event, that's coming up a little bit later in the hour. Here is some good-ish news. This comes from actually late November. It was something we didn't get to, but I wanted to get to it at the time. Something must have been going on in late November. I can't imagine what it was. But this is important, and it also feeds into our main story here today. But in Wisconsin, a panel of three federal judges found that Wisconsin's legislature, their 2011 redrawing of state assembly districts, favored Republicans in an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. And it was the first such ruling in three decades of pitched battles over the particular issue. Federal courts have struck down gerrymanders on racial grounds, but not on grounds that they unfairly give advantage to a political party, which is the far more common form of gerrymandering, and it's something that has been used by Republicans of late, even in other areas like photo ID restrictions, to say, well, we weren't trying to keep black people and Hispanic people from voting. We were just trying to keep Democrats from voting, as if that's okay. And to some extent, it is okay. It is the Voting Rights Act that they're trying to avoid when they make that argument. And they're trying to make a similar argument here when it comes to gerrymandering. But a federal court in Wisconsin, a three-judge panel in any event, has said that what they did was illegal and unconstitutional. And that means the case can now go directly to the Supreme Court.
The U.S. Supreme Court?
Correct. Okay. Where its fate may rest Anthony Kennedy, who has expressed a willingness to strike down partisan gerrymanders, but they're trying to find a rationale to explain it, to accept it. They've got to come up with a legal reason to say why partisan gerrymanders are actually illegal and unconstitutional, and the federal court now in Wisconsin may have come up with such a reasoning. Should the U.S. Supreme Court affirm the ruling, it could upend the next round of state redistricting, which happens in 2021.
Right after the next census in 2020.
Correct. For congressional and state elections nationwide, most of which are likely to be conducted now by Republican-controlled legislatures that have swept into power in no small part due to this type of gerrymandering. Several election scholars have said that the ruling was particularly significant because it offers for the first time a clear mathematical formula for measuring partisanship in a district, something that had been missing in previous assaults on gerrymandering. And that's something that the U.S. Supreme Court, at least Anthony Kennedy, has been asking for. The 2-1 ruling by the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin said that the legislature's remapping violated both the First Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment because it aimed to deprive Democratic voters of their right to be represented. Although Wisconsin's natural political geography plays some role in the apportionment process, the court wrote, it simply does not adequately explain the sizable disparate effect of Republican gains in the state assembly after these new boundaries were redrawn. The boundaries of both federal and state legislative districts are redrawn every 10 years, as you mentioned, and after the census to ensure that each district contains roughly the same number of people. But if you've ever looked at a partisan redistricting map, and this is true even when Democrats draw them, they are these, you know, crazy sprawling districts meant to group together Republicans or Democrats or black people or white people. And when it's done racially, that has already been determined to be unconstitutional. But now this ruling determines that a partisan gerrymander is also unconstitutional. We'll keep our eyes on that as it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And one of the things that's really quickly about this is that this shows why the 2018 elections are so important, the midterm elections for which Democrats and young people tend not to show up as in great numbers as they do for presidential elections. And so when you have your opportunity to elect your state representatives, 2018 is a good time to
do it. It matters, but it's hard to make it matter when they've redrawn these districts to make it so difficult to actually change the partisan makeup of the state assembly.
It is difficult.
And that is also what was done in North Carolina. So that story that I just shared with you from Wisconsin, that was the third week in November. 1 week later, a federal court in North Carolina ordered the state to hold a special legislative election next year. That following 28 state House and Senate districts found to have been redrawn to comply with a gerrymandering ruling. U.S. District Court judges earlier this year had thrown out the current legislative district map, ruling that 28 of them were unconstitutional racial gerrymanders in this case. They nonetheless allowed the 2016 elections to proceed under those old maps, but they have now ordered state legislators to draw new districts in 2017 and hold a special election. That settles the question of whether new districts would take effect for the regularly scheduled 2018 election you mentioned, Desi Doyen, or if a special election would be required. Well, now it will be a special election in 2017 in North Carolina. The three-judge federal panel wrote in their order that while special elections have costs, those costs pale in comparison to the injury caused by allowing citizens to continue to be represented, I should say misrepresented, by legislators elected pursuant to a racial gerrymander. And yet, that's been going on for years now in North Carolina since they redrew the maps after the 2010 census. The order gives the state assembly until March 15 to draw new district maps. Every legislator whose district is altered will have their current term shortened. So everyone in the House, potentially, because as they redraw these maps, it's likely to shake up more than 28 of these districts. So everyone in the House and the Senate in North Carolina could be facing a special election in just a few months. Republican legislators who oversee redistricting, of course, blasted the decision after it came out. They called it a politically motivated decision by the court, which would effectively undo the will of millions of North Carolinians just days after they had cast their ballots. This was back in November, right? It is a gross overreach that blatantly disregards the constitutional guarantee for voters to duly elect their legislators to biennial two-year terms. That's the statement from Rep. David Lewis and Senator Bob Rucho in their press release after the court decision from the U.S. District Court. If the Supreme Court hears the case and overturns the ruling, the special election would be canceled and the current districts would then be restored for the 2018 election. So they get away with this for decades at a time. Now, why am I bringing this up now? This came out in late November. Well, A, we were busy with a few things in late November, but also because of what is now going on in North Carolina that is absolutely breathtaking. Yes, we spent a lot of time on this show over the past year or two talking about North Carolina, and there's a reason. Because they are, in fact, leading the nation in right-wing extremism. And that's really what it is. Remember, these guys who were upset about this effectively undoing the will of millions of North Carolinians just days after they cast their ballots back in November? Remember that? Well, what's going on in North Carolina is just breathtaking. Remember, so all of that that I've just read you, the outrage from the Republicans, that came after the November election when Republican Donald Trump and Republican U.S. Senator Richard Burr had both won the state. But at that time, voters also voted a Democratic judge onto the state Supreme Court, tipping the balance of the state's high court towards the Democrats. And for the first time in state history, it rejected the sitting governor. It rejected the state's incumbent governor, Republican Pat McCrory, by almost 10,000 votes in what was a very close race out of about 4 million votes cast in North Carolina. But McCrory went on for several weeks claiming that there was massive voter fraud in the state. We talked about that on the show. His claims were almost entirely rejected by both the Republican majority state board of election and by the Republican majority county boards of election. In North Carolina, both the state board of election and the county board of election are headed up. They're odd-numbered boards that are headed up by whoever, whichever party owns the governor's mansion, essentially. McCrory, the Republican governor, had for several weeks called for a statewide recount, which we supported, by the way, because we think that voters should be able to verify their votes, that they were counted accurately. Even supporters of the abhorrent Republican governor, Pat McCrory. But eventually, McCrory conceded that race to the Democratic Attorney General Roy Cooper. So it's with all of that background, then, that the state legislature, the state assembly in North Carolina, which still, by the way, has a supermajority. They've got a supermajority. They can overrule anything any Democratic governor, incoming Democratic governor, has to say, at least for now, at least until that special election happens. But for now, they've got a supermajority. And so with all of that, they called an emergency session this week. Initially, it was to vote on funding for hurricane disaster aid following October's Hurricane Matthew. But after that work was done, after they approved $200 million in disaster relief, the Republican Assembly, the unlawfully gerrymandered Republican legislature, the unlawfully gerrymandered lame duck Republican legislature, immediately called another emergency session without telling anyone that it was going to happen. And they immediately began adding in bills to largely dismantle the powers that the new Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, would have enjoyed after he is sworn in as the new governor next month. I mean, it has amounted to, in the last 24 hours in North Carolina, to what some are calling a coup, and one of the most extraordinarily audacious power grabs, sore loser power grabs, ever attempted by a state general assembly. So looking at what they've actually done, what they're actually proposing to do, what they're actually trying to ram through in this emergency session, beyond the disaster recovery legislation that they had approved on Wednesday, Republican lawmakers quickly proposed sweeping changes to state government, including proposals that would diminish the governor's authority to make appointments. This, according to the Raleigh News and Observer, lawmakers are trying to hobble the incoming Democratic governor before he takes office on January 1 by making his cabinet appointments now subject to approval by the state Senate for the first time in state history, cutting his ability to appoint members to, amongst other places, the University of North Carolina School Board, Board of Trustees. One proposal in the mix, they say, would equally divide election boards. I'll get to that. Remember those election boards that I said were headed by Republicans until now? Well, now they would be evenly divided between the two major political parties if this moves forward, ending control by the governor's party. And another provision would cut the number of employees who serve at the governor's pleasure from 1,500 down to 300. That reversing an expansion that was approved specifically for the Republican governor, Pat McCrory, at the start of his term. So, fun fact, when McCrory was first elected and replaced then-Democratic Governor Bev Perdue, the Republican-controlled legislature expanded the number of gubernatorial appointments from 500 to 1,500, allowing Pat McCrory to cede the entire state government and all the state commissions with damn near anybody he wanted, 1,500 appointees, and now the Republicans are trying to reverse that and only allow the new Democratic governor to appoint 300 people. So I guess all of those other people who have been hired by the Republicans, they will stay. They will burrow in and they will run Republican government.
Yes, yeah. They will implement those Republican policies and be in a position to not implement the Democratic governor's policies.
Correct. Two dozen bills were filed late on Wednesday. The ones most likely to move forward represent a significant shakeup by the Republican-controlled legislature. The Republican House Rules Committee chair said, I think, to be candid with you, that you will see the General Assembly look to reassert its constitutional authority in areas that may have been previously delegated to the executive branch, adding that legislators will, quote, work to establish that we are going to continue to be a relevant party in governing this state. Mind you, they have a supermajority, as is. They currently have a supermajority. They can pass anything they want, even after January, and the new Democratic governor can veto it. And they can override his veto with their supermajority. And yet, they're in there fighting now to remain relevant, to remain a relevant party in governing this state.
When total power is just not good enough.
Exactly. They still want more. House Democratic Leader Larry Hall said that Republicans were trying to nullify the vote of the people. And remember what I read you about these very same Republicans? Blasting the federal court for this redistricting, saying that it would effectively undo the will of millions of North Carolinians just days after they cast their ballots? Well, now Republicans are trying to effectively undo the will of millions of North Carolinians just a month after they had cast their ballots. Roy Cooper, for his part, said that the General Assembly should focus on higher teacher pay, better wages for working North Carolinians, and repeal HB2, the anti-LGBT legislation that was passed by McCrory that cost hundreds of jobs, if not more, millions of dollars to the state of North Carolina, and is one of the reasons that Pat McCrory was run out of office. So Cooper, talking about, they should focus on higher teacher pay and better wages. Of course they should. But that's not the Republican Party at this point in 2016. They are playing by completely different rules. Frankly, they are playing a completely different game than Democrats are in North Carolina, in Washington, D.C., and frankly, across the country. The Republican House Rules Committee chair said that some of the appointments and election board changes were prompted by Cooper's election, he admitted. Some of the stuff we're doing, obviously, if the election results were different, we might not be moving quite as fast. Yeah, you think? They are playing a different game than Democrats are. Democrats need to figure this out all across the country. On the proposed Senate role in confirming cabinet members, Lewis said, "We believe firmly that it's important for the legislature to be able to work with and communicate with the governor and the governor's cabinet selections. The framers of the Constitution felt that the Senate confirmation was important." Well, that sounds reasonable, except that's not what they have been doing under Republican governors and then in previous years under Democratic governors. They just haven't done that. So now, all of a sudden, not only are they going to limit who the number of employees and appointments that Governor Cooper can make, the incoming governor, the Democratic governor, but now those people are going to be subject to approval by the Republican Senate. But this is getting, this gets worse. So stand by. This is, we haven't even got, so Lewis, the Republican, said, "We're trying to reaffirm that our state employees are in fact professionals, but the governor and the council of state still have the right to pick their top advisors." So they can pick the people at the top, but all the people hired by the Republicans with no Senate confirmation, those people get to stay. Now we get to the part that's even worse. I had mentioned the boards of elections. The governor, this is just amazing, on the Board of Elections, it will be changed from what there had been two different commissions here. There was the State Board of Elections and the State Ethics Commission. And now the Republicans are trying to merge those two boards. And in doing so, change the State Board of Elections from a 5-person commission to an 8-person commission, with 4 Democrats and 4 Republicans. Previously, it had been a 5-person board, again, headed by whatever the party of the governor was. But now they're going to change that to make it a bipartisan 4-to-4 state election board.
I hear deadlocks coming.
The bill would also change the makeup of the county election boards from the current 3-member boards, 2 of which belong to the party of the governor, to 4-member boards with an equal partisan split. Right. Gridlock, you mentioned, coming on these boards?
Deadlock equals gridlock.
Yeah, well,
yes.
They have a solution for that. Now, it might make sense upon hearing this that, well, they're going to evenly split the election boards. That's fair. Previously, it had been, the Republicans, when they were in power, they could run anything through those election boards they wanted. Democrats could do the same. Now it's going to be even Steven. Well, that might make sense, frankly, had it not been so off balance for so many years. But here's how they decide. Here's how they avoid that gridlock. There will be one of the two parties, either the Republicans or the Democrats, will chair these so-called bipartisan boards in different years. So Republicans, they're being fair about that, right? They'll split it up. Sometimes it's Republicans, sometimes it's Democrats. Well, according to the bill filed, they would rotate back and forth, rotate years, with Democrats chairing the committees, the election committees, whether it's the state board of election or whether it's the county board of elections. The Democrats will chair the committees in odd-numbered years, and Republicans will chair the election committees in even-numbered years. You're probably ahead of me on this one. That means that the presidential election years, the congressional election years, the gubernatorial election years, they will all have, according to state law, Republican chairs in charge of the election committees in those years. With the exception of the court-ordered special legislative election for 2017 that we discussed, and a couple of school boards and municipality elections, all elections in North Carolina are held in even years, when now the Republicans will chair all of the state election commissions if this bill goes forward.
It's a pretty neat cheat when you think about it.
You think? And it's even worse. In deciding disputes and resolving issues on these evenly balanced boards of election, a simple majority of 5 of the 8 votes won't get you a squat, apparently. They are also, according to this bill, changing it so that a majority vote for action requires 6 of the 8 members.
Oh, my God.
Back to your gridlock, Desi. That's exactly what this is meant to do, to basically freeze things in place any way they can. And by the way, the bill also undermines a good chunk of the Secretary of State's current authority. The Secretary of State doesn't actually have all that much authority for elections in the state of North Carolina. This bill would undermine the Secretary of State's current authority, who, surprise, just won re-election as a Democrat. It gets worse. A Senate bill that is proposed here would shift power from the North Carolina Supreme Court, that will be controlled by Democrats, as I mentioned earlier. It will shift some of that power from the Supreme Court to the 15-member state court of appeals that has a Republican majority. Lawmakers propose removing the right to make a constitutional challenge in a direct appeal straight to the state Supreme Court. Instead, a process, and by the way, that was approved by the Republican-led legislature when it had control of both of the legislative chambers and the governor's office, and it had a 4-3 majority on the state's highest court. At that point, they decided if you had a constitutional challenge, you could go straight to the state Supreme Court.
That was then. This is now.
Now they're changing it, at least under a bill introduced on Wednesday. Any such cases would first have to be heard by all 15 members of the Court of Appeals, the Republican Court of Appeals, before the state's highest court could review the challenge.
That's quite a gauntlet that would have to be run for anybody.
Listen, that happens in some places. They say, oh, you got to go to the appeals court first. Okay. But they had changed it when they had a Republican majority on the Supreme Court, and now they're changing it back now that they lost it. They are stealing that court. They are stealing this entire state. They are playing by entirely different rules than Democrats play by. There was talk, by the way, that they were going to expand the state Supreme Court now that the Democrats gained the majority, that they were going to add 2 more seats and allow Republican Governor Pat McCrory, before he leaves office at the end of the month, to add 2 more Republican appointees to it. That one is off. Instead, they're doing this. Instead of a court packing bill, said Anita Earls, director of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. They have represented many challengers to the General Assembly's election law changes since 2013. She said instead of a court packing bill, it appears we've got a court denial bill. This proposal seems to delay Supreme Court review of cases, including those involving citizens' constitutional rights, for example, concerning voting. Unconstitutional laws could now be in effect for years before the state Supreme Court would finally get the case and make a ruling. Just the way this unconstitutional state assembly has been in place and making rules for years since they unconstitutionally put this partisan gerrymander in place to give them the supermajority that they are now using and abusing in North Carolina. There was more to this, but it is just absolutely amazing what is going on. Obviously, Democrats are criticizing the session because, for one reason, 3/5 of the legislators in both chambers have to sign a petition to call a special session. And apparently, the session began on Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m., but the petition that was signed by 3/5 of the legislators was dated Monday. So they knew they were going to do this as of Monday, and they didn't tell any of the Democrats that this was going to happen. They knew for 2 days that there would be a new session, a new emergency session. And Democrats are challenging it on that basis alone at this point, because not only did they not know this special session was, this emergency session was coming, they had no idea about any of these bills, these dozens and dozens of bills that were suddenly dropped after they announced it. Governor Pat McCrory, who is still in charge for a few more weeks and could sign these bills if they pass, he's on the way out the door. He hasn't said whether he'll sign it or not, but one of the Democrats, U.S. Congressman David Price, said in a statement, "American democracy may be more fragile than we realized." Oh, do you think? Roy Cooper said this is about thwarting the governor's ability to move us forward. Oh, do you think? Most people, he said, think that this is a partisan power grab. Oh, do you think? Hundreds of people packed the Capitol in rally on in Thursday to express their concern about how this hurricane relief emergency session was being turned into a partisan politics play. But some Democrats are having deja vu. The last time Republican lawmakers called a high-profile special session was back in March, when they ended up ramming through one of the state's most controversial laws in recent memory. That was the bill limiting what public bathroom transgender people could use and municipalities' ability to pass anti-discrimination laws for LGBT people. That was following after the Republicans jammed through what is regarded as the worst voter suppression law since the Jim Crow era, much of which has now been thankfully knocked down by the federal courts as being unconstitutional. But yeah, it's a coup. Yeah, it's a power grab. Republicans play for keeps. Democrats continue bringing butter knives to automatic assault rifle fights that are being waged right now by Republicans all over the country and at the federal level. And these fights, I gotta say, are very difficult to win when the people that you are playing against have absolutely no interest in rules. They're not even playing fair. It's very difficult to negotiate and win with someone who is not an honest broker. But that's who we're dealing with now at both the federal and the state level. And Democrats need to wake up and figure that out. I don't pretend to know what the solution here is, but this is going to get much worse before it gets better. Republicans in state after state are fighting like hell to make sure that this happens everywhere, to make it impossible for Democrats to legislate even when they win elections. I'll have more on that after this break. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to The Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Desi, do you have that that Denzel Washington clip handy? This is Denzel Washington at some premiere or
it's
another.
At the premiere of his they're doing revival of Fences.
Okay. Well, he was asked about the problem of fake news. And not just by the fake news purveyors, at least the way he responded, but also by the corporate media, which has a tendency to wildly disinform and misinform the American people, as they did all throughout the election cycle, and as they continue to do today, and as they continue to not focus on things that matter. They look at the biggest shiny object, and they misreport on it. And they don't wait to figure out what's actually going on and what's not going on. And, you know, ignoring so much of the stuff that we try to cover every day on this show that has effects for years and decades at a time. Anyway, here was Denzel Washington on Wednesday.
What is the long-term effect of too much information? One of the effects is the need to be first, not even to be true anymore. So what a responsibility you all have to tell the truth, not just to be first, but to tell the truth. We live in a society now where it's just first. Who cares? Get it out there. We don't care who it hurts. We don't care who we destroy. We don't care if it's true. Just say it. Sell it. Anything you practice, you'll get good at, including BS.
Well, they have gotten very good at BS, it seems to me, and very good at not focusing on the things that matter. Here's something that matters. Again, from late November, one of these items that I've been trying to get to that I haven't been able to. A former screenwriting partner, apparently, of Steve Bannon, who is now Donald Trump's senior aide. What's he called? The political director?
Chief advisor.
Chief advisor. Yeah, he's basically the white supremacist Karl Rove.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
is what he is. He used to run Breitbart. He said, this screenwriting partner of Bannon said that Bannon had once mused that it might be beneficial to restrict African-American voting access. This is the guy, the chief political consultant in the White House if Donald Trump ever gets there. Writer Julia Jones had told the New York Times in an interview that Bannon, so I guess his name is, the position is chief White House strategist.
There you go.
Bannon would occasionally claim that some people were genetically superior and once had suggested that the vote should be limited to property owners. Jones said that she told Bannon that such a policy would exclude a lot of African Americans. And apparently, according to Jones, Bannon replied, maybe that's not such a bad thing. Jones said, well, hey, what about your longtime executive assistant who happens to be black? He said, well, she's different. She's family.
Oh, boy.
So that's the way that the guy who's going to be Donald Trump's chief strategist thinks. And that should work out very well, because that's actually the way Republicans across much of the country now think about voting. Ari Berman reported a week or so ago that less than a month after Trump unexpectedly carried Michigan by just over 10,000 votes, Republicans in that state legislature were already pushing to make it harder to vote in the state of Michigan. And they were trying to jam through a strict photo ID law, restriction law, through the lame duck legislative session before the end of the year. Under the current Michigan law, a voter who does not present photo ID at the polls can sign an affidavit confirming who they are under penalty of perjury, and then they can cast a regular ballot. But under this new bill, which passed the House Elections Committee on a 5-3 party line vote on the first day of the month, voters without that strict ID would now have to cast a provisional ballot, and then they would have to return to the local clerk's office within 10 days of the election with a photo ID in order to have their vote counted. Now, mind you, even if we go by the numbers that we have out of Michigan, where they were running this recount, even while they were passing this law, they were trying to recount the votes in the state of Michigan. That recount was stopped, was obstructed. The Republican Party went to court and did everything they could to get it to stop, despite tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of votes that could not be recounted due to Michigan's terrible election law that we've been talking about for the last several weeks. And that's after all of the ballots across Michigan have never been counted by human beings. They were counted only by computers in a presidential election that for the first time in decades went to the Republicans by a mere 10,000 votes. Well, in this past election, according to Ari Berman, a little bit over 18,000 people had voted without having the photo ID now required and had to use the affidavit option to vote. At least they were able to cast normal ballots. But that's 18,000 people. That's 8,000 more votes than Trump's reported margin of victory in the state of Michigan. One third of the affidavits come from Detroit, where Hillary Clinton won 67% of the vote in Wayne County. Trump's discredited lie that millions voted illegally in 2016 seems to be impacting Republican actions in the state of Michigan and elsewhere. GOP state rep Lisa Lyons, who sponsored this bill to make it harder to vote in the state of Michigan, said a multitude of candidates have raised the concerns about the integrity of elections. We need to respond to those questions. We're going to make sure that we're protecting you, all voters, and the integrity of the election. I guess she said this with a straight face, because remember, while this attempt at a hand count was going on, that same Republican Party was going to court and saying there was no fraud in the state of Michigan. There is no fraud. As Berman says, Michigan GOP on the recount, no evidence of fraud. Michigan GOP on voter ID, fraud, fraud, fraud. But they don't care. They don't care that they're lying to the people, because they can pretty much count on the media not pointing out these hypocrisies.
Yeah, who's going to stop
them? Republican Party. Who's going to stop? Nobody's going to stop them now.
I mean, look, we still don't have a Supreme Court justice, and it's been nearly a year, and the media has completely dropped that whole idea.
They've moved on.
Oh yeah, you know,
they've moved
on
because did you see what Donald Trump did? Like Trump, Berman notes, Lyons presented absolutely no evidence of voter impersonation or other types of fraud to justify the bill. And then she passed the bill in her committee after just 2 days of testimony, when the rest of the state was otherwise preoccupied with the recount. And what was amazing was that the Michigan election officials, they were busy working on this aborted recount at the time, so they couldn't even come and testify. There was just one election official who was able to come into the Michigan legislature to testify on this. Kent County Clerk Mary Hollenrake said, "I'm about the only clerk who can be here today because of the massive recount we're preparing for. This comes as a large surprise. We have not had time to look at these bills." So that's what they're doing. They're surprised. They're dropping these bills out of nowhere when Democrats are completely flat-footed and can do nothing about it. And it's not just in North Carolina, and it's not just in Michigan. It's up in New Hampshire as well. Newly elected GOP Governor Chris Sununu has called for eliminating same-day registration in New Hampshire, despite the lack of fraud apparently caused by same-day registration in New Hampshire. And Republicans in the state legislature also want to tighten the residency requirements for who gets to vote, and who doesn't get to vote. In Wisconsin, Republican leaders called for cutting early voting again after a high early voting turnout in Democratic cities like Madison and Milwaukee led the Republicans to say, we've got to do something about this. People are using it to vote. House Speaker Robin Voss said, we're probably going to have to look at it again to make sure that everybody in the state has the same chance to vote. It's all about fairness. In Texas, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has called for reviving the state's strict photo ID law, which has been repeatedly struck down by court after court after court, state court, federal court, appellate courts. It's been found to be discriminatory over and over again, and yet he listed reviving that law, that racially disenfranchising law. He's talked about reviving that as one of his top 10 priorities for the 2017 legislative session, saying, I know we're going to do photo voter ID again. You better get some of our old rerun shows ready, Desi Doyen, and we'll be able to run those like crazy in 2017, and they will still be accurate. They will still be true.
Hey, there's a method to that madness, because it means that, yeah, sure, it's been struck down, but if you redo it, it'll take that many years again to strike it down, and oh, what damage you can do in the meantime.
So Democrats, pay attention. Not just Democratic voters, but Democratic lawmakers. You are being hosed. You are being played. You are being pwned, as the kids say, in every single regard. You are playing with people who are not only not playing by the rules, they don't think there are rules. They don't think the rules apply to them.
Who is going to stop them? Nobody right now.
I was hoping you were going to say you were. We did have a question about who will stop them. Where is the leadership in the Democratic Party? There really is none right now. We had a question yesterday, email to bradcast@bradblog.com about exactly that, and I've got no good answer. There's some question about what to do on the Supreme Court and some various things that could be done if Democrats had the balls to do it. But I don't think we have time for that, unfortunately, now. It's going to have to wait until I'm back after our next thrilling broadcast, because we got to take a quick break and get to the Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. I'd like to say the who's going to stop them. The answer to your question, Desi Doyen, is the Supreme Court. Nicole Sandler is going to be in for us tomorrow, so I won't be able to get to that tomorrow. But on our next thrilling episode, maybe we will. Some talk about what to do about the Supreme Court, which has been stolen. And I'm not one of these guys who runs out and yells stolen elections and this and that. But if everything moves forward, as it looks like it is going to, this Supreme Court has been stolen by the Republicans, who didn't bother with the rules, didn't bother with the norms, didn't bother with the tradition, didn't bother with the Constitution that says the sitting president gets to fill a Supreme Court vacancy. They just said, nope, we're making our own rules. We're not going to hold a vote. We're not going to even meet with this nominee, Merrick Garland. We're just going to steal the Supreme Court. And let the American people should get to decide. Well, guess what? The American people decided they wanted Hillary Clinton as president. So shouldn't the American people also get to decide who the next Supreme Court justice will be, going by the Republicans' own thinking? Anyway, I said we didn't have time to talk about that. We don't, because we have to get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
Yes, our climate's changed. They've been changing for ever since the Earth was formed.
Trump taps former Texas Governor Rick Perry to head the nation's nuclear arsenal.
Over regulation, excessive bureaucracy is stifling our ability to innovate.
Trump's pick for Interior Department, not a fan of oil and gas regulations. EPA now says fracking does harm drinking water supplies. Plus, the Arctic is unraveling.
All of that unraveling and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The Department of Energy, I believe, has the highest ratio of PhDs per employee of any of the agencies, because it's doing all of this physics and energy research and weapons research. And so it's a good thing that Rick Perry got those glasses that made him smart.
Yes, it is. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, I'm just wondering if former Texas Governor Rick Perry will finally learn how to say the word nuclear now that he's been tapped to head up the nation's nuclear arsenal.
Yes, one would hope. It's true, Donald Trump has selected former Texas governor and fellow Republican presidential candidate Rick Perry to head the Department of Energy. This is the same Rick Perry who once famously forgot he wanted to abolish the Department of Energy.
The third agency of government. Yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third. Sorry. Oops.
Oops. Apparently, the Department of Energy is so inconsequential that he can't even remember its name.
Well, hopefully he knows that it's not focused on oil and gas, but instead on managing the nation's nuclear weapons and advanced physics research, not really his area of expertise.
What is his area of expertise?
That's a good question. The Energy Department researches climate change, but Perry is a climate science denier who calls climate change contrived and phony. When Texas was grappling with record drought a few years ago, Perry's response as governor was to call for 3 days of prayer.
Oh, like that didn't work.
Meanwhile, the current Department of Energy has responded to a chilling questionnaire sent by the Trump transition team requesting that they name names of scientists and employees who worked on climate issues, but the department has bluntly refused to comply. The Trump camp now says that questionnaire was, quote, unauthorized.
Sure it was.
Donald Trump's pick to head the Interior Department is a first-term congressman from Montana, a Republican representative named Ryan Zinke. Interior regulates the nation's natural resources, public lands, and oil and gas drilling. Zinke is an avid hunter who is strongly against the push by some Republicans to transfer federal public lands to the states.
Well, that's good.
But he does support loosening regulations on domestic fossil fuel production and accelerating fossil fuel exports.
Not as good.
Some of these rules that are being made by unelected bureaucrats that don't even know where Montana is in the map. I think we do need to export liquid natural gas.
Zinke is also a soft climate science denier, meaning he acknowledges that it's happening, but he objects to doing anything about it. And that makes him a denier. Speaking of climate change, the latest Arctic report card, released Tuesday by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is alarming. The Arctic just had its hottest year ever recorded, 6 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than in 1900. Record high monthly temperatures were set in the winter months when it is darkest and the Arctic should be actually very cold. In a statement, the scientists said the Arctic used to, quote, whisper change, but now it is shouting.
Well, maybe, but in the world of Trump, no one can hear you scream.
All of Trump's cabinet picks support expanding fossil fuels and oppose action on climate change. Joe Rome, founding editor of Climate Progress and himself a physicist and former assistant secretary of the Department of Energy, on the broadcast this week notes that Trump campaigned on gutting climate science programs and research. So environmental groups will now have to redouble their efforts.
We clearly are going to have to make a stand because it is literally the fate of the next 1,000 years, the irreversible nature of climate change that will be decided in the course of Trump's administration.
Oh, we can worry about that later.
Finally, the EPA has revised its draft report on fracking and now says fracking does harm drinking water in some circumstances, a significant reversal that has angered the oil and gas industry. The revision came after the EPA's independent science advisory panel said the evidence did not support a widely publicized claim in the EPA's draft version that downplayed fracking impacts as not widespread or systemic. But in this final version of the report, the EPA now acknowledges fracking operations can harm drinking water.
I'm sure we'll correct that record soon. For much more on all of these reports and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. I told you we were going to have trouble on this episode of the broadcast. Des, before we get out, you had a quick follow-up on that EPA matter where the EPA has finally admitted that, yes, in fact, fracking can harm our drinking water supplies.
Right. That report that they had revised, that draft report in 2015, was somehow somebody edited it. It's said to be a higher-up EPA official. Nobody knows who. Nobody knows exactly when they did it, but they changed the press releases to make it sound like the EPA had concluded that the fracking drinking water impact were not widespread and were not systemic, so don't worry about it. That was widely touted in the media, and since then the evidence has come out that that the forced the EPA to revise that and say,
so
no, that's
was
not true.
They did a study. This is, they found this stuff, and then they added to the press release this information to say
it's
information that was not in the actual study.
Right.
It was counter to it, and nobody knows who did it.
Right. And now it's been revised, so that's good, but it's not getting the same play in the media for some reason.
As it did a year ago when they said, no, no problem with fracking and drinking water.
Yep.
Well, you know what? Kanye West is meeting with Donald Trump, so that's got to be covered. You know, that's that story, that breaking news story is not going to cover itself.
Priorities.
My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's greatly appreciated. My thanks also to all of you who have stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do what we try to do 5 days a week right here on the Bradcast. Thank you very much. You can drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And you can find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. As I said, Nicole Sandler is back guest hosting the Bradcast in our next thrilling episode. We will see you thereafter on the day the Electoral College casts its votes next Monday. That could be a big day, or it could just be a regular day. We'll find out then. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.